If one ever has to decide what's more important, the talent of the athletes or the coach, always take the athletes, because you can't win without great athletes. And, you know, that's the debate people are having now about Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, who's more important. I think they're both important because they're, you know, Belichick's a great coach and Tom Brady's a great quarterback. But hey, without Tom Brady, Bill Belichick hasn't been winning, you know. So I think I learned that talent is critical. How you relate to that talent is really important. Defining roles for athletes and so that they know what's happening. And, you know, above all, you've got to enjoy the game.
This is the Leave It Better podcast, powered by the Side Out Foundation. Here's your host, Hall of Fame coach, Janice Kruger.
Today, I have the pleasure to have Terry Laskevich, who has a rich history in our sport as a coach and as a teacher whose leadership and vision influenced, in my opinion, the growth of volleyball in the United States. Terry, welcome to the show.
Janice, thank you for the kind words, and my pleasure to be here today. So,
I'm going to go through a little bio here, just to give the folks that are listening. This is really going out to a lot of our folks in the Side Out Foundation Dig Pink community, we hope, and beyond. And so I want to just give them some of your background. Terry was the former collegiate and U.S. national Olympic team coach, in which he mentored thousands of coaches. I'm going to say thousands. I was going to use hundreds. And administrators for his lifetime. He was a head coach of the women's Olympic, national and Olympic volleyball teams for 12 years, flowing from 1985 to 1996. During that time, he received a bronze medal in the 1992 Barcelona Games with his team. In 1995, you were honored with the International Coach of the Year honor, in which that year your team, our Olympic team, won the gold medal in the Grand Prix and also a number one world ranking. You have co-founded the Collegiate Volleyball Coaches Association, which is now known as the American Volleyball Coaches Association, AVCA, co-founded the Art of Coaching Volleyball, which has a series of national and international coaches clinics where you can attend in person and also via the internet. You can gain this knowledge as well. I'm also sharing some of the educational background of you because I like to have this available to people so they know who your alma maters were and can locate you in that space and time. You did your BS degree in biology at Loyola University Chicago, master's degree at George Williams College, and I believe Jim Coleman might have been your advisor at that school.
He was, yes. He was my advisor, and I was his assistant coach. So,
oh, gosh,
yeah,
fun.
For the men's team there.
PhD from the Ohio State University in physical education and emphasis in sports psychology and international sports. And I know along the way, you had some interest in other things besides volleyball coaching, maybe in the medical field. We're not going to go too deep into that, but I am going to close out here with an amazing stat in which you have been named in 6 volleyball halls of fame. Terry, where do you get so many halls of fame opportunities?
You know,
that's
I don't
incredible.
Know. Well, thanks, Janice. Listen, volleyball has been good to me, and I think it's been a good symbiotic relationship for me for volleyball. And, you know, it all started, like you mentioned, an immigrant kid. And, you know, I came to this country when I was 3 and lived in Chicago in the Ukrainian village. And all my formative background was in the Ukrainian community. And I grew up playing table tennis, soccer, and really did not start playing volleyball till I was 17. And it led me to, as you mentioned, I was a biology major pre-med, and I went to medical school for a year. And at that time, I started playing on Jim Coleman's club team, Kenneth Allen, and decided that, you know, hey, it's time perhaps not to be a doctor and quit and to be a volleyball player and slash coach. So that, to the chagrin of my Eastern European Ukrainian parents, but it's all worked out. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how that went over.
No, it didn't go over very well. But, when you think of what my parents went through to come here at age 39 and 35 with two kids and form a new life. For them, it was, as any ethnic group that's an immigrant group, education became your toolkit to get to where you want to go. And, you know, I understood, and I always used to tell them, everybody can't be a doctor, lawyer, engineer in the Ukrainian community. Don't we need plumbers and carpenters? You know? But anyway, it all turned out. So
you were a little bit of a comedian too at that time, sounds like. I'm not sure your parents appreciated that.
I don't know if it's a comedian. I'm a realist. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to say a couple of things. You know, when I think back about when I first saw you, I'm not sure I even met you, but I remember as a young coach, I was coaching in Division II at that time, and you were at the University of Pacific, and your teams were so successful, and I used to not have tons of opportunity to see you in person, but if you got to the playoffs and you were in them very often, and so I got to see what you were doing with your team, how you coached them. And I could see the results of your training and teaching with that program. And I remember it being something that was pretty inspiring to me at that time. And I ran across a story that I think I may have, by accident, that when you were the head coach at the University of Pacific, that John Dunning was a high school math teacher that learned a lot by being in the gym with you. Can you tell me a little story about that?
Sure. Well, John and I met, you know, John was a math teacher and basketball coach at Fremont High School in the Bay Area. And the volleyball coach had left or resigned. I don't really know the story. And the AD had asked John to be the volleyball coach. And John took his first volleyball clinic with me in 1977 at Pacific in Stockton and slept in his truck. So that's how we first met. And then John kept coming back to a subsequent clinics, and then he became very successful at Fremont High School. He also started the Bay Club volleyball team that was a national champion under his tutelage, and he replaced me at Pacific at the end of 1984. And, you know, people think that I chose the coach. I did not choose the coach. There were three great finalists for that job, and those finalists were John Dunning, Russ Rose, and Ken Preston, the head coach of the Santa Barbara men's team. And the committee, I knew once we have three great candidates, either one of them, hey, will be great. And I didn't have any decision making. And John became the head coach. And obviously, under John, won two national championships in 1985 and 86. So yeah, he did a great job with that team. John's a very good friend of mine and a great coach and a super person. And he's had great success in all his career, both at Pacific and at Stanford.
So, mm-hmm. So do you see, when you watched John's coaching in those early years, Pacific and then probably even at Stanford, could you see your influence on him? Was there anything that you would go, yeah, John, that was something I led you into?
Yeah, John is a very bright person that also has a very analytical, mathematical mind. I think we share a lot of similarities in the way we teach certain skills. Mm-hmm. John breaks down every skill methodically. And John is amazing because he never played volleyball. So to me, that takes a certain kind of skill set and certain kind of, I think, analytical background to do that. But I, you know, I think John was influenced by several different people. I'm one of them. And, you know, I think we share similar outlooks on the way perhaps of treating people and skill teaching. But, you know, that's probably it.
So you mentioned that he wasn't a player. And I found out in my conversation with you that you were quite a player. In fact, I saw a picture that came my way of Terry Laskevich up in the air pretty darn high, taking a big swing at a volleyball in which the blocker was Wilt Chamberlain.
I don't know where you got that shot, but yeah, that was in the Chicago Tribune. And that was probably about 1973, I would guess, around that era. Kenneth Allen played a series of exhibitions against Wilt and the Big Dippers, it was called.
The Big Dippers.
Several national team players like Larry Rundle, Gene Selznick, Kirk Kilgore. Lots of those people played with Wilt. So it was interesting to play against them. No, look, I was an above average volleyball player. Kenneth Allen was a great team. Jim Coleman, the Olympic coach, was the coach of that team. There were a lot of great players on that team. You know, I was, you know, people like Mick Haley played on that team, Tom Bierman, Jim Vineyard, Bruno Andriukaitis, both of those, and Tom Bierman and Mick were, they played on the national team for a while, and lots of great players, Gordy Lindstrom, Gus Baltibolz. It was a great opportunity to become, you know, I started, as I said, at 17 and I played with the Chicago Ukrainians and we were always the little engine that could. And we, you know, I was our tallest player. I was a middle blocker when I started, you know, so at a little bit over 6 foot tall. Times have changed.
Times have changed.
But no, I got bitten by the bug to play volleyball. And I think certainly my tennis and my soccer backgrounds really helped me in playing volleyball. That's why I'm such a big fan of multiple sport athletes. Yeah. And I think kids should play multiple sports. I was above average and that's about it. But you know, when I watch the men's game today, I say, did I ever play anything that even looked like that?
You know? So, yeah.
Yeah. It's the game's changed a lot. Lots, the people are taller, quicker, faster, stronger, like in every sport. So
it is amazing. So let's turn to a little different space because you were, as I mentioned, the co-founder of the Collegiate Volleyball Coaches Association with Andy Banikowski. And at that time, why did this, you guys are out there coaching volleyball and you saw the need for this to come into our sport to bring everybody together. And that is now the American Volleyball Coaches Association, but you co-founded that. So your intention at that time, and then where is it coming to fruition of what you were dreaming it could be?
Well, you know, I'm going to take a little step back. You know, first of all, one of the reasons I went to Pacific, I was coaching men at Ohio State, and we were highly successful with that men's team. We went to two Final Fours, actually the first Final Four Ohio State ever went to was with me in 1975. We're going to have our 50th reunion next year. And that team, three of the people on that team played on the men's gold medal team in 1984, Aldis Berzins, Mark Waldie, and Rich DeWillius. So from coaching men, I was assisting on the USA women's national team. I was Ari Selinger's first assistant coach in 1975.
I did not know that.
It's a long time ago, yeah. And so when I went to Pacific, one of the reasons I went there is that at that time, there were three powers in volleyball, and they were USC, UCLA, and Hawaii. Mm. And Hawaii was just really beginning their kind of ascension. But I knew Andy because Andy was the assistant coach on the men's team at UCLA while he was the head coach of the women's team. And I knew if I came to Pacific, I'd have a chance to, you know, we started playing a home and away with UCLA in 1977, my second year at Pacific. And the first match we played against them, they literally beat us in 28 minutes. They were the defending national champions. And anyway, Andy was always great for the game. And what we, I think, did, and people don't realize it, is that we wanted the sport of volleyball to grow. One of the things that Andy and I really pushed for in 1983 is to regionalize the volleyball so that you don't have in order to get to the Final Four, you'd have to beat USC and UCLA. We were in the same region. So they gave opportunities to Penn State, Nebraska, Texas to get to the Final Four, which I think was great. So that's an example. We looked at the sport. How do you grow the sport? Back to the CVCA, AVCA. I went to USA Volleyball in 1979, and I said, we need a coaches association. And the reason was, at that time, because of the beginnings of Title IX, Title IX was passed in 72, but enacted in 75, 76, we started getting more and more people that were professional coaches. I mean, there were some really good coaches in the AIW, but a lot of the people, most of the people in the AIW before the NCAA were former teachers. Yeah, they were teaching and coaching. And now all of a sudden we just had a new professional kind of subset of, hey, here's just somebody hired to coach. And we felt that coaches needed a forum. So I went to USA Volleyball and they kind of laughed at me, you know, and typically, look, I have no love for the administration of USA Volleyball, never have. I think they are short-sighted. Mm-hmm. I think they've always been short-sighted. And we then said, let's start our own coaches association. And so Andy and I and Sharon McAlexander, there was Andy's assistant coach, became the first executive director. And Sharon did a great job. And then obviously one of the great ones was Sandy Vivas.
Yeah.
And then followed by Kathy DeBoer. I think those three were the most significant executive directors. And the organization is way beyond anything we ever imagined. All those ladies did a great job growing it to be what it is today. And it's kind of comical to me that USAV, that laughed at the AVCA in the beginning, now has such a big presence that people think it's USA Volleyball doing it. They have nothing to do with it other than they show up. You know, so I think even when I was the national coach, I made sure that we were always there with the national team. I wanted to make sure that that is an opportunity for the coaching community to see volleyball at the highest levels. So we always had a practice during the AVCA Nationals, the Final Four. But so that was one of our impetus was, hey, how do you grow the game? How do you make the game more than just in little pockets? At that time it started, you know, the three pockets of volleyball, certainly when I was playing for women, were Southern California, Chicago, and Texas. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of the three pockets. EPU with Mary Jo Pepler and her teams in the Houston area. Those are the great Texas teams, the Shamrocks and the Renegades on the West Coast. And Chicago had its Rebels and it had Chicago Volleyball Club and ASA. And there were some. So those are the pockets. But the game became a national game. And it's really grown. The issue is that we've never marketed the game correctly. Mm. And no one can tell me today who is on the national team if they're not some volleyball aficionado. Whereas everybody knows, for example, on women's soccer, Alex Morgan, Mia Hamm, you know, any of the top players, because they're on television. And we've never had our sport on television until we started getting both the Pac-12 network and then the Big Ten network and then the SEC and the Texas Longhorn network showing the game on TV. Because no matter what anybody says, marketing a sport is still television.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to be televised and you've got to have, yeah, now you have streaming services and so forth. Those are all great. But hey, there's a power when 159 million people watch this last Super Bowl. And, you know, American football in 2023, the top 10 shows in television, what is it, 8 or 9 of them are football.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, everybody knows anything about it. So I think in a roundabout way, that was the impetus of Andy and I. How do you get the game more exposure? How do you get it to different regions than just the Southern California region? And I think we accomplished that, certainly. And, you know, we're very proud of what's been done, certainly, with the AVCA.
Yeah. You know, as a young coach, I remember those conversations that were going on and just the drive you guys had for TV and understood, you know, regionalization and trying to send the balance of the game, move it around a little bit. And, you know, what a wonderful thing that happened, because it now is all over the country and very strong places and a very different game from way back when. And I want to say one more thing is I did appreciate as a young coach when you would bring that national team to the AVCA convention where I could see, because for me back in those days, that was a very important part of my learning about the game, seeing athletes play, to be there in person. And so this brings me to, and I'm going to try to switch into the art of coaching volleyball that you co-founded as well. And when I think back, we learned a lot early on, at least I did, and actually went to like camps, coaching camps, where I would mm-hmm. spend a week there with other coaches and learn the game. And I think about you when you were in that Chicago area or with all those famous names that you have mentioned, and you're all together, and just how important that was for learning the game, continuing to grow in the game. And it was something about you that I really admired you, because I could see you. I got to see you. I may not have been able to touch, but I could see you there. You would bring the product to us to see. That was very excellent.
Again, thanks, Janice, for those kind words. You know, two things I need to say. One of the things I learned, Jim Coleman was not only a very good coach, he was an educator. And he wanted to teach the game. And I remember, you know, my first volleyball clinic was with Jim Coleman, you know. So I really always pushed having clinics and had a whole series of clinics in the 70s and 80s myself that I organized under several different banners, Sports Associates and American Volleyball Coaches Clinics. I mean, all those I did. The one thing that I'll mention that is, I think, when I was the national team coach, because we had our sponsorships with lots of different people, like from Mizuno to Kentucky Fried Chicken to
I remember that one.
to Yugo America to all those things. Made us play 32 to 36 matches a year in the United States, the women, and 32 to 36 men. That we did from like 1983 until 1996. Then it stopped. I think that was the great growth of the game, that people saw the national teams. Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully the pro leagues will be able to do that, you know, but sure. I think that's a big mistake that USA Volleyball stopped doing that. Also, that was a way to pay for the national teams, because we were getting sponsorship dollars from those entities to pay for the national teams, and not just the dues that are paid by, you know, kids or I know that they have sponsors and sponsors pay money to, but it was a way for people to see volleyball. And I wish USA Volleyball would do more of that. But anyway, that's mm-hmm. aside. So.
Mm-hmm. Hi there, Janice here. I want to take a minute to tell you about something very personal and important to me, my job. I'm the brand ambassador to the Sight Out Foundation, and I've been a part of it since it began about 20 years ago. Believe it or not, I was recruited to join the Sight Out team by the founder's father. He looked me up online and asked me out to lunch. That's when I got to learn more about his wife, Gloria. Gloria is the reason this Sight Out Foundation exists. Her son and husband wanted to give her more time, and it worked. Gloria was this fiery redhead that was so full of energy and joy and happiness. They'd invite me and my partner over to Thanksgiving, and Gloria would dance around the house. She always made me feel so welcome. I joined the team at Sight Out for the very same reason we get athletes involved with our Dig Pink program, because I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. I wanted to see Gloria have more time, and I was thinking about all my female friends I could potentially be helping. One of the goals of this podcast is to let people know that they can help us help people living with metastatic breast cancer see more tomorrows. How? By harnessing the passion and power of youth volleyball to raise money that will go toward real research and clinical trials that really do give families more time with their loved ones. That's one of my favorite things about this job, is that you can actually see the results of our research and how it helps give people more time. For more information, head to our website, side-out.org. Now back to the show. Yeah. So starting as a collegiate volleyball coach and then transitioning to an Olympic coach, what was that transition like? Are there any stories of things, of struggles or great things that happened that you remember about that time? Because what an interesting situation for us in the U.S., just building strong international
for sure.
Competition.
Well, I don't think people realize this. So the 1984 team for the women was very successful. They were the silver medalists, and they were maybe one of the best teams in the world from like 1980 to 84. But they all retired. So we started from scratch.
Yeah. Okay.
And our first competition was February of 1985. Against the Korean club team, not the national team, the number three Korean club team. We played seven matches and we didn't win a match.
How about a game?
We didn't win a game.
You
look at 10 years later, we were number one in the world. So the growth there, but you know, there's a big difference. And part of it, people don't realize this, is that if I'm an NBA coach or an NFL coach or a WNBA coach, talent is dissipated among 25 to 30 teams. The national volleyball team has 18 to 20 players that are all four-time All-Americans, three-time All-Americans. They're the go-to player on their college team. And the hardest thing is role definition. One of the things that I learned on my very first trip, that 1985 trip, we had a player, Bobby Brower from Stanford, and she was a three-sport athlete at Stanford, basketball, volleyball, track and field.
Wow.
And Bobby asked me a question. She says, Terry, what does a substitute do and think about? I said, Bobby, what are you asking? She says, since age five, I've never been a substitute for 1 minute in any sport I've ever played. And that was a great question, because now these are the people that are, you know, we had every player of the year from 1983 through 1995 in college. You know, so those are people that may be getting 40, 50 sets a match, and now all of a sudden they're a role player. You know, how do you work with that? So it was always, to me, defining roles. You know, one of the things that I really learned on the national team is the individual meetings that you would have with a with one of our players need to be codified. So we'd always have, you know, I'd never meet with them alone, but I'd have a staff member. We would take notes during the meeting, and then we would show those notes to the athlete and say, hey, is there anything we missed here in the notes? Add this or that. And we always talked about role. We talked about that they have questions, and therefore it was there. So they can't say, hey, we never talked about my role. I don't know where I am in the pecking order. What do I need to do to start? What do I need to do to travel? So that really taught me. That was, and then I employed that when I came back to Oregon State, and that's a whole discussion in itself. But I think that was something that was very different. The similarities were, look, If one ever has to decide what's more important, the talent of the athletes or the coach, always take the athletes, because you can't win without great athletes. And, you know, that's the debate people are having now about Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. Who's more important? I think they're both important, because they're, you know, Belichick's a great coach and Tom Brady's a great quarterback. But hey, without Tom Brady, Bill Belichick hasn't been winning, you know. So I think I learned that talent is critical. How you relate to that talent is really important. Defining roles for athletes, and so that they know what's happening. And, you know, above all, even, you know, we talked about some of the questions you'd ask. I'd say that to a beginning player, to a national team player, to a pro player, you've got to enjoy the game. If you don't enjoy the game, hey, you got to have fun playing the game, and fun for, play to me is maximizing the pleasure of the moment. So for some people at the high levels, that means winning in competition. That's my fun. But I think people need to enjoy the game. I've always asked, you know, when I was at Oregon State, we'd have towards the end of my tenure there, we'd have seventh graders visiting. And I'd always want to say, you belong at Toys R Us. You know, what are you doing here? But the mom and dad would be there with him, and I'd say, can I ask your daughter a question? And they'd say, sure. And first thing I'd say, do you enjoy playing volleyball? Because if you don't, you're never going to be good, because you're going to have to spend a lot of arduous hours, repetitive tasks. You're going to learn how to fail, all of those things in order to become good. And I think that, you know, there's a pyramid effect from when you start, maybe in middle school to high school to college. Maybe you make the national team, but let's think the reality. If there's 18 to 20 players on the national team, how many millions started out in middle school or play club or play high school? You know, it's tough to, if that's the only reason why you're playing, you're in trouble. So I think, you know, the chances in youth sport today in America, anybody that plays youth sport, 97% of all of them will never play in college. 99% won't have a scholarship. And then if you're in college, let's take even the NFL and NBA. What is it? 1 to 3% will play in the NBA. You know, so the pyramid gets steep to get to that top level. But then you're dealing with a very different type of athlete.
Yeah.
They're eccentric. They're a genius talent-wise at what they do. And a lot of them are very different, and you have to treat them in a lot of different ways. And I've always said, I'm going to treat you fairly, not equally, you know, because you guys aren't equal, you know? So
yeah,
that's kind of been my mantra. So,
I remember a few times when I was going through this process of getting my players to understand what I meant by fun with regards to, you know, execution. Sure. And precision and all those things. So I love that you mentioned that. And you know, I like to see that people stay in that space. I don't think you continue doing a lot of things if there's not there's some joy in it, whether that's a serious joy of being better every day, attaining something that, you know, you set a real high bar. But to me, that's fun. And I love that you mentioned that.
And that's well stated by you, because I think for anybody who's in the athletic field in any sport, hey, part of it is the scoreboard. And people may say, well, hey, it didn't matter if we won or lost. Yes, it did. Now, the whole thing, it's the process. And I think it's like the great John Wooden. John Wooden never talked about winning.
Yeah.
He talked about the process. You know, if we execute our skills and our tactics, we're going to be fine. You know, he never even had a scouting report. And I think that that's what one wants to do to, hey, set a goal. If I don't get there, set another goal. But you've got to love the game, enjoy playing the game. And if you don't, it becomes tougher at any level of college play, whether it's D1, D2, D3, it's a job.
Yeah.
Because I've got my academics, my sport, my social life, and that should be just a little sliver, you know. But yeah, it's different. But there, you know, there's similarities at all levels. And the one that I've always said, you know, this is a interesting story. When I started at Pacific, who was the coach at San Jose State was Jane Ward. And Jane was one of the great U.S. players. She was the captain of the 64 and 68 Olympic teams. Mm-hmm. And in my second year at Pacific, Jane said to me, Terry, I'm watching what you're doing. I'm hearing what you're saying. You're doing a great job. Just keep saying what you're saying. Keep doing what you're doing, because the light bulb will go on for a third of them in 2 or 3 years. For 2/3 of them, the light bulb will never go on. But you just need a third and you'll be great. And that is exactly right. You know, I mean, she told me that all the teams I've ever had, you'd have 4 to 5 really bought in, committed, hardworking players. Another mentor of mine was Bill Walsh. I was lucky to meet Bill in 1977 when he became the head coach at Stanford for his first head coaching job. One of his best friends was Glenn Alba. He was the golf coach at Pacific, also taught there as I taught there. And we started the sports psych program together. And he went to high school and college with Bill. So that's how I met Bill. But Bill would always say to me, he said, Terry, to be great, your best players have to rest, W-R-E-S-T, rest the control of the locker room away from you. And I'm fortunate, Bill would say, that I have Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, Ronnie Lott, three people that are probably the best in their position at that time in the history of football. But they were the committed, they were the, you know, it's like if a Karch Karai says to you on the team that he's playing as a captain, hey, do this. Hey, well, he's the hardest worker. He's the best player. You're going to listen to them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I think, same for every team I've ever coached, that you need that buy-in from at least a third of your team in order for you to be great. So
saying that, I totally agree on that. And I know my best teams in terms of our final ranking, each year, those teams were basically, it was the players that took over the ownership. You still coached them. You brought
for
the strategy.
Sure.
You did all those things. And when they bought into that, and then the rest of them, they just piled on and they got into it, and they would come into practice. We would have our best competitions actually in our gym, getting ready to go play a game.
That's critical.
Yeah. You talk about the coach. So you have the players and you're trying to build this culture basically, or the expectations for them.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of advice would you say to coaches, and really even players too, because they have to understand the need and the value of having that culture so everybody is more together and everybody's rowing in the same direction?
You know, establishing culture, you know, that's a big buzzword in the last 10 years, culture, team culture. Well, I think it can't be just a mission statement or a series of bullet points that you put up on the board in the beginning of the year. You have to live it every day in practice. You got to have a theme throughout that you can go back to. And it has to be, like we said earlier, is the buy-in. Like you said, hey, you're really good teams. The players are the ones that drove the quality of a practice, quality of any interaction and so forth. So that takes time to develop. And I really think it's something that simply stated is culture is what happens when no one else is watching.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, hey, or let the other team sing your praises. As an example, if I'm playing Penn State with Russ Rose coaching it, I know they will never beat themselves. They will have relentless pursuit, and they will cover every ball that's blocked, you know. So he doesn't have to tell me that that's their culture. I could see it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what one really wants. You know, there's a terrific, for coaches, there is a terrific piece by a coach, Greg Carville, that you can get on YouTube.
Okay.
Greg Carville is the UMass men's ice hockey coach. And when he took over UMass, they were in last place in their league 4 years in a row. And in 4 years, they won the D1 national championship. And it all is based on one of the great books about culture and leadership that's been written. It's called Legacy. It's the book about the All Blacks rugby team from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And it's what made them for 100 years a quality team. And so I think it's all, you know, you got to build that. And people, like when they won the national championship and they're interviewing the UMass players, they all spout what Greg preached. Character trumps talent. You know, they all said that. Now, they all have talent. You can't just have character people that don't have talent, you know. Yeah. So I think you got to pick those cultural items. You got to build those with your team together, but your team has to push them. No one else can push them.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have the team bought in and the team doing that in the locker room when you're not there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Some people have said to me, well, you know, if you were only interested in coaching, you would have won national championships in college and on and on. And I tell people, hey, if I would have stayed at Pacific, we would have won several national championships. But that never was the driving force. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like the difference between winning and losing. You know, in 1994 in the Grand Prix, we lost by a couple of points to get to the finals, you know. And then we win on Deuce 18-16 against Brazil the next year. We beat, you know, in 1995, we beat China 3-0, Cuba 3-1, and then Brazil 3-2 night after night to win the number one ranking in the Grand Prix. But the difference in those matches, it's always a couple of points. We lost two semifinals in Division I NCAA Final Four, 15-13 in the fifth.
Yeah.
You know, hey, you switch those points around.
Yeah, I used to use that. I'd total them up. I'd give them to the players. I'd say, see, it's
not all. For sure.
Here's this and this. So
yeah.
When I ask you to, like, every point matters. That's why. All right. You were in these six Hall of Fames.
Yes.
How did you feel when you were there being inducted into that? What kind of emotions, what kinds of things came through you during that time?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the emotions that come through are the players I had that put me in a position to be in that Hall of Fame. So you keep thinking of the players, you keep thinking of the staff and the coaches that you worked with. You keep thinking of your family that was very supportive of you doing what you were doing and being away all those long hours or days. So all that comes to mind. You know, it's never a singular. I could never have had the achievements I've had as a coach without the great players that played for me and without the great staff members that I've had. So those always come to mind. And, you know, some I talk to all the time. In fact, right after this, I have a call with my first team captain at Oregon State, Abby Swancutt, who worked for Nike and now is off on her own. And I keep in touch with my Ohio State captain, Tony Gaines, once every 2 months.
That's amazing,
Tony's planning the 50th reunion of the 1975 team, and Tony was the best captain that I ever had.
Yeah.
You know, Tony was a fifth-year senior, married, and did things that I never even knew about.
That's true.
Those are the people that have, if people call me, I'll always call them back. And even players, I'd do anything for my players, but I don't interfere with their lives once they leave, you know, because I think what I've always said to people, my proudest things of coaching is, even at Oregon State, everybody that played for me for 4 years mm-hmm. graduated. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing I've ever done. Now, even at Oregon State, we had the all Pac-10 or all Pac-12 academic.
Yeah.
Number 3 was Cal, number 2 was Stanford, number 1 was Oregon State. In all the years that I was there, as to the amount of players that were on the all Pac-10, Pac-12 academic team. One of our players, Jill Sawatsky-Stelson, that works in Art of Coaching since 2014, was the scholar athlete of all sports in the Pac-12 in her senior year.
Darn.
So those to me are the things that endure, because, you know, awards, Hall of Fames, wins and losses, they're like leaves on a tree. They fall
they
off,
fall
you
off.
Know? So you got to just, to me, it's always been the process. It's always been the enjoyment I've had from doing what I do. I've never worked a day in my life because I've just enjoyed everything I've done. And that to me has been the fulfilling message to show my children, my son and daughter, hey, you've got to have a meaningful job that you really like, and then also give back and also make the world a better place, because we have that finite, you know, that microscopic place in the world that when you compare it to the millennium of people that have been around, is really kind of insignificant. But have you made the world a better place? Have you, you know, I'm also proudest of, you mentioned earlier, mentoring coaches. You know, I've mentored hundreds of coaches. I'm wonderful to see some of the people that started with me. Marie Zydak, head coach at DePaul, Emily Heise-Cohen, the head coach at Colorado State, Natalie Morgan Ragin, the interim head coach at Long Beach, Luke Maloney, associate head coach of the men at Ohio State. So those have always been kind of important to me, because I think I had an effect on making them the people they are. And that's what I love doing. So,
you know, and I'm going to leave that with how Terry sees him leaving it better, since that's the name of this podcast, that's what you have done.
I like it. And I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I should have got it in just before you started to answer that question. Hi there. I want to take a minute to tell you about the Dig Pink program. You most likely know I've got some history as a head volleyball coach. Coaching for me was about providing opportunities for my players to grow and learn life lessons and to become the best volleyball players they could be. At the Side Out Foundation, we believe in using the power and influence of sport to build student athletes as people on and off the court. Players learn the value and importance of giving back to their community, working as a team, and taking initiative to get involved, all while directly helping people living with metastatic breast cancer and funding game-changing research. That is the Dig Pink journey. Dig Pink gives those wanting to do good a chance to be a part of something bigger than just volleyball. For more information, head to our website, side-out.org. All right, back to the show. The last question. Okay, promise, last question. Do you feel you have potential that you have not yet unblocked? And if so, what does that look like?
Well, look, it's like what I used to tell players, you got to get out of your comfort zone. So you need to know how to learn how to fail. I think I've learned how to be maybe even a better parent by having my grandkids, you know, because I've spent more time with them. So doing that better would be good. I have very few regrets. You know, some of the jobs that I really wanted, I didn't get. the head athletic director job at Pacific in 1983-84, but the one, the executive director of volleyball in 1988. I really feel that I would have had volleyball in a whole different trajectory if I would have been the executive director. But, you know, hey, life went on, you know. So other things I have yet to, you know, the way I'll leave this is the best is yet to come. So we'll see.
Okay. You know, I said at the very beginning of this that I had turned on a YouTube presentation you were doing to coaches and talking about coaching equals teaching. And you were going through the parts of that. And you moved me. I'm just watching you right there, and your passion and your energy has been like that as long as I've known you. And I feel as though, and you said this earlier, that you're open for a conversation. If somebody reaches out, you're going to let some engagement happen there. And I thank you for all of those things that you are, Terry, and for leaving volleyball a little better, and life, I'm sure, those around you and the companies and all the things that you have. It's quite impressive. And I want to thank you for being on today. I've had a great time. I love talking to you. And if you come up with something else you want to get on here and chat about, and you know, our mission with the Side Out Foundation, which is who's really helping me put this on, is to help us treat and give people living with metastatic breast cancer more time. And with volleyball out there, that's what's happening. And we are so thankful, and to you for all the help you've provided to us through your art of coaching and your outreach there. It has always made a difference. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Janice. And thank you for what you do with the Side Out Foundation, because I know it's meaningful in a lot of people's lives. Yeah. And it's a comfort to those that are all of a sudden have a tough diagnosis to deal with. Right. But life goes on.
Life goes on.
Life goes on. So thank you. I enjoyed this, and we'll see what happens to this great game as we go forward.
Yes. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you for listening. Please share your feedback with us at www.side-out.org.